Thanks, Charlie. My name's Nick. I'm an addict.
Hi, Nick.
Yeah, thank you for asking me to do this, and thank you, Karis, for a fantastic chair. Whoa. There's a power in this room. I can feel it. There's a real power. And thank God, because I don't have power over my addiction. I thought I did, but I don't. The power of two or three addicts together is stronger than the illness, but this many addicts together, all wanting the same thing, to get better, to have some peace, to stay clean, is a very, very powerful thing. And it kind of, it frightens me and it excites me at the same time. I was kind of, for work, I've had to learn to do a bit of kind of public speaking. And normally what I do is I get myself all sort of psyched up and effervescent and like this and start, you know, like that. But this is NA, this is recovery. And I was saying to Charlie earlier on, after the first time I got clean, I signed up with some health insurance. My medical records had been lost. And when I needed it, I ended up in some treatment facilities which they paid for second time round. And in one of these places, they gave me a thing called a verbal that I had to say at the beginning of every group. I had to sit there and say, "My name's Nick, I'm an addict and an alcoholic, and my vulnerability is my greatest strength." And every morning when I woke up, I knew that I was going to have to say this, and it just stuck in my throat sometimes. But, you know, listening to you, Karis, and I know in my heart, when I really open to the people around me in recovery, that's when I start to get well. So I haven't been feeling that good this week. It's just felt difficult and hard work. All of the fantastic things I've got in my life have felt like a bit much. And I was thinking about doing this, and I was thinking, yeah, but I have my home group on Thursdays, and if I go and do the thing on Friday, I won't be able to go to the home group on Thursday and go out with my mates. But then I thought, no, this is a tremendous opportunity and an honour to share my experience with you all. So thank you, really thank you for asking me. My dad was a big drinker. The way it was at home was everybody drank. They drank if they were feeling bad. They drank if there was something to celebrate. They drank if it was one of those days where there was nothing bad or anything to celebrate. They just drank. And as I understood it, that's what you kind of did. The way you managed your feelings was you took a substance. So as soon as I got the chance to do it, off I went. And I was very excited about the idea of drugs. And so when I got the drugs that I first got, I was excited about that. And I smoked some dope and I thought, this is fantastic, I want to do this all the time. And then I found some acid and I took that and I thought, no, I don't want to do this all the time. In fact, I had a theory for quite a while that the only reason I was in these rooms was that I'd taken some acid, or too much acid, and some weird things that happened in my brain, and everything that happened after that was a kind of horrible attempt to readjust the kind of mental damage. And if I could sort out that mental damage, I'd be able to use normally addict thinking. Anyway, so that didn't last very long. Then I discovered coke and I thought, I want to do this forever. This is fantastic. I feel wonderful. And then I discovered the thing that I really like, which is heroin and all the things like it, all the opiate things. And I thought, this really is the thing and I really am going to do this all of the time. And I did for a bit. And then, you know, my habit would get too big, and I'd go to the country and cluck and think, it's going to be fine. You know, the 3 or 4 days of the flu, and my mum would say, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" I said, I just got the flu. And then there'd be that fourth or fifth day where I'd be emotional. And I'd be watching the telly, and there'd be an advert for, you know, Andrex or something. I'd see the little puppy, and I'd be weeping, and I think something's not quite right here, but I'm not sure what it is. But I've succeeded in stopping for 3 or 4 days, so obviously I'm in control of this. And I'd score. And the whole cycle would start again. I was completely bewildered by it. I had no understanding of what was going on. I thought it was all about the drugs. And I ended up in a therapeutic community in Lancaster called Inward House. These therapeutic communities at the time, this is in the sort of early 80s, made honourable attempts to kind of help us to get well. But one of the problems was that they believed in reintroducing addicts to social drinking. So it all went very well for about 3 months. So a lot of scrubbing floors, and I learned how to cook and all this kind of stuff. In these very angry groups, we'd all shout at each other. And then I think I reached the 3 month bar and I was allowed to go and have a drink. I was taken out with a guy who was allowed to have one pint a night, and I was allowed a half. So off we go together. He has his pint and I have my half. And we do this for a few nights. And then one night I say to him, as his pint is getting really low, I said, "I really don't mind how much you drink." He said, "Well, I don't mind how much you drink either." So off we went and we got very, very drunk. But the thing which was scary was that from that point on, it took about 4 days for me to have plotted a way in which it wasn't my fault that I got thrown out of the house, and got thrown out of the house at the right time of day to be able to get a train that got me to King's Cross in time to school. And the whole thing started again. 4 months of nonsense, really, because it was all going on. The addiction was going on. So then I met this girl. Fell madly in love. She was surrounded by coke dealers. That was good, too. My story was, I'm a recovering heroin addict. Everything's fine. So I was using everything else in front of her and using the heroin, you know, on the quiet. But I decided, she was an extraordinary woman, she was very talented, very beautiful, and I decided that I wasn't going to lose her, whatever happened. So when inevitably it became clear that I was still using gear and it was all sort of falling apart again, and I was in the, I got busted, and so I went to a methadone clinic in the now closed Westminster Hospital, the top floor of which we still have H&I committee meetings in, down there. And I was waiting to pick up my script, and two people from NA were talking, as I understood it, to the nurses in this detox. And they went on and on and on and on about recovery, and I'm thinking, I want my script. Come on, hurry, stop talking. So eventually they finished talking and I got my script, and then a few nights later I was in a restaurant at one of those dinners that somebody else is paying for, so I'm ordering away at the drinks and the waitress is giving me a funny look, and I think, what do you know about me that, you know? And then I looked across the room and the maitre d' of this restaurant was one of the people who'd been sharing in the detox three days before. So in my somewhat inebriated state, I went up to him and I said, "Oh, I remember you from the detox." You know, so the way you do, embarrass the poor guy. But actually he was fine. He said, come back into the kitchen. And he introduced me to all of the waitresses and waiters who were all in recovery. And they were running this restaurant and they were just doing this thing, and it was just so attractive. That was the thing that got me. I thought, because always before I thought, you get clean and you live this kind of grey life in a kind of metaphorical box, and everything has to be, you know, small and grey and sad. And their lives weren't like that at all. And they said, come to a meeting. So a couple of nights later, I came to my first NA meeting, which, this is in 1984, in a place in Millman Street in Chelsea. It was a men's hostel, and you walk in and then go down into the basement. That's where the meeting was, a bit like here. Except when you went down into this basement, all you could smell was urine. It was this terrible, terrible stench. So going down the stairs, smelling the urine, thinking, this is a bad idea. And then I hear this laughter. And I go into the room, and I listened to people like us saying things out loud that I thought were the sorts of things that I only thought secretly in my head. You know, I mean, some people have talked about this and said it was just as if, you know, I thought they'd been spying on me and were recycling my thoughts. I didn't think that. I just thought, this is the first place where I found people who are clean, who are talking to me in a language that I understand about experiences that I have in my head all of the fucking time. And they were talking about their struggles to stay clean. Some of them were stoned, you know. And by the way, if you're here and you want to get clean and you're stoned, it's fine. You're just as welcome as anybody else. Please keep coming back. And it was just wonderful. I mean, I didn't like the idea of total abstinence, but the way that the meeting was, the power of the identification, the laughter, was so powerful. It really got me. I thought, I've got a way of staying with this woman, because I'm going to be able to get clean, and it's going to be okay. So I did all the stuff that we do. I sort of accepted in the end that I wasn't going to be able to drink, and I started going to meetings every day, and I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps, and I did service, and I got married to this woman who I dearly loved, and everything looked like it was going very well. I got a job, we bought a house, we had children. Everything was going so well that I started going to a few less meetings, quite a few less meetings. Her life was really taking off. She was a painter. She was becoming very, very successful. She was kind of quite a lot more successful in what she was doing than I was in what I was doing. And while I did this big thing of, you know, being totally cool with that, it was eating me up inside. I didn't like it at all. She was very attractive. All these guys were around, kind of flirting with her all the time. Fuck off. So I was a little angry, I think. But also, I was completely kind of, I loved this woman, you know, she was everything to me. So then I'm not going to very many meetings, and she comes to me and she says, I'm having an affair with this guy, and I'm gonna go off with him. And the children really like him, and it's all going to be fantastic, and we're going to LA next week, all this kind of shit. And I just fell apart. I fell apart. I found somewhere else to be, and I was actually living in a kind of... This is healthy, isn't it? I was living in an ex-girlfriend's flat while she was in treatment. It was all a bit kind of fragile. And she had a load of Solpadeine in her drawer. And I woke up one Sunday morning just feeling completely kind of heartbroken and lost and fucked. And I thought, you know, no reasonable human being goes through something like this without taking the Solpadeine, if the Solpadeine's there. It sounds like a small thing, it's a little bit of codeine, but, you know, for me that lit the fuse. This is after, what was it, 10 or 12 years of recovery. But recovery that had started to kind of tail off, probably years before, actually, years before. And I thought I had it together for a bit. I was, you know, I'll take a bit of this and I'll take a bit of that and I'll put some Angostura bitters in my tonic because that's okay. It's not okay, by the way. It's 40% proof. And it was all this playing around the edges of, you know, well, I've still got my job and everything's going okay and, you know. And then, a few weeks later, she comes to me and says, I've made a terrible mistake. Can we get back together? And I say yes, but in my heart, it's all fucked. So we try and make this marriage work for another 2 or 3 years. She's a migraine sufferer. And she was a very, very subtle sort of addict. And she became addicted to the kinds of stuff that the private doctors will give migraine sufferers. Prethidine, morphine, morphine sulfate, DF118, all that Omnipom, all that kind of stuff. Prescription opiates. And So all of that was going on, and we're back together. But I'm furious because she's fucked off with someone else, and because it didn't work out, she wants to come back to me. So the migraines get worse and worse and worse. So clearly she's got some sort of anger issue that's not being resolved, or maybe she's just got migraines, but she's addicted to pethidine. And this is the mad bit. The doctor says eventually, because every time we went to the doctor to get her the pethidine injection, it was X amount of money. He said, look, you know how to use these things, don't you? I said, yeah. Why don't you inject her with the pethidine? I'll give you a box of pethidine. So we do all of this for a little while. It's very slow drip, all this stuff. And it's not until about 3 or 4 months later that at 11 o'clock in the morning, I think, I'm not going to have a cup of coffee. I'm going to have a hit of pethidine. And off it went. Off it went. Next stage. Within a few months, I'm in Amsterdam, in a little hotel next to the needle exchange. So out of my head, I wake up in the middle of the night. She was called Sarah, this woman. I think Sarah's next to me. I start talking to her, but she's not there. I had this moment of clarity, and I thought, I'm going to die unless I get out of here. I'm wandering around the airport with a bottle of vodka, kind of begging people to give me a flight back to England. And eventually I get back here and try to start getting clean. But in the midst of all of this, the job goes, the marriage goes, the relationships with the children are broken. Any trust that I've developed with anybody is broken. And I'm back to kind of square one. I was somebody who came into NA sort of direct rather than through a treatment facility first time round. And the second time round, I thought, when I was ready, I thought, I'm just going to go to meetings and I'll get clean again, it'll be fine. I just couldn't do it. I just kept relapsing. I thought, I'll go to AA, maybe I'll try going to AA and using drugs, but not alcohol. So I've got a tea commitment at an AA meeting and a heroin habit. I mean, just hopeless. I say all this because it's just, you know, it's the progression of the illness. You know, I was using more recklessly and with much less ability to kind of grind to a halt and get a day clean than ever I'd been 10 years before that. And, you know, that's what they say about the illness doing press-ups and all that kind of stuff. All of that stuff proved to be true. All of the other stuff that people say in here proved to be true as well, which is everything you put before your recovery, you will lose. And I lost it all. And eventually I had a big car crash, and that was kind of the end of the road. And I ended up in a couple of places. And, 3 months in a halfway house. And by the time I was out of there, 3 months in a halfway house, when you've got children and on Christmas Day you're sitting in the halfway house with 3 or 4 other guys watching The Deer Hunter, it's as grim as it gets, actually. Now, it's a great film, but it's as grim as it gets. You know, thinking, I should be at home with my children, you know, and I'm not because I fucked it up. So by the time I'm out of there, in all sorts of ways, very understandably, my wife says, that's it, we're separating. So this time round, I kind of think, I know NA works, I've got experience of it working, I know I can stay clean if I do all the stuff that's suggested, but I kind of, to be honest with you, I thought I'd fucked it, and I might be able to stay clean and have some sort of message of recovery eventually, but I'd always feel like shit. I felt like shit for a couple of years, to be honest with you. And I was doing that thing that some of us do when we've broken up from marriages and we have children, of picking up the children on a Friday and dropping them back on a Sunday. And, you know, that was kind of this curious mixture of heaven and hell as well. You know, I'd miss the children all week, pick them up on a Friday, be completely freaked out by the fact that they were there, get used to the fact that they were there by Sunday night, by which time it was time to drop them back again. And the beauty of that time, the beauty of that time was that I really had to lean on this. And all my reservations were gone. I tried the reservation of, if this woman stays with me, I will stay clean, and that clearly did not work. And I found myself feeling terrible, going to meetings every day, and, you know, starting life again, living on my own for the first time in years and years and years. So I'm just about beginning to get it together, and I've had my year on my own, and I've got a new girlfriend, and that's going really well, and the relationships with the children are kind of getting better, and I've got used to the kind of weekend dad routine, when my ex-wife by then, Sarah, I get a phone call from her brother. He says, Sarah's dead. So what do you mean? I don't believe this. What's happening? She was still taking these opiated things, and she got pneumonia. But she didn't know that she had pneumonia, because the cough instinct when you're taking opiates is suppressed. So she'd felt pretty bad suddenly, apparently, and rung the doctor, and they said, well, you better go to hospital because we can't get to you. So she goes to the hospital, and she's sitting in the hospital, and they're stabilizing her, and they're putting the antibiotics in her. She's got an abscess in her lung, which bursts, which they haven't spotted, and she dies of septicemia within minutes. And the children come home from school that evening to be told their mum's dead. And so she was with another guy by the time that she died. So the other guy's in the house with my kids, the former matrimonial home, as the lawyers call it. And I'm, you know, what do I do now? So there followed a period in which these three grieving children and I and my ex-wife's family tried between us to try and kind of hold this situation. I was kind of 2 years clean. I was pretty raw, actually. I was thinking, fuck, I can't cope with this. And then thinking, no, it's not about me. It's about my children. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And we didn't hold it together very well because my ex-wife's family were very angry with me. And they didn't believe that an addict who'd relapsed as spectacularly as I had once wouldn't do so again. And if you're a citizen on the street, actually, and you look at the statistics, it's a fair cop. So we end up in kind of... Well, they say... My wife's family said, listen, you've been through a difficult time and you're very vulnerable. You can't really look after your children, so we're going to. And I think, this is going to end up in a court battle unless I kind of do something. And so I end up with a solicitor, and the solicitor says to me, you realise what will happen if you go to court with these people? They'll throw everything at you. The medical records, everything. The statistics. Can you cope with that? Can you stay clean? And I thought about it, and hand on heart, I thought, no, I can't do it. So I let it go, and I let the situation with them looking after my kids and me kind of seeing them like a weekend dad, I tried that for size for a few months. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live with it clean with the feelings that that brought up. And also, I knew in my heart of heart that wasn't right for the children. And in the end, I knew that I had to fight for the children even if I lost. So, I went away for Christmas and I wrote a fourth step. And I shared it with my sponsor. And then I picked up the phone. Actually, before that, this is the power of NA. You know, if you've got a legal problem, it's the same as a drugs problem. You just ask people in NA and they'll tell you the right thing. Eventually, I found somebody who said, when I was getting divorced from my wife, she had this solicitor who was so terrifying that I settled straight away. Get her. So I got this woman. She was unbelievable. So I ring her up after Christmas and I say, right, let's do it. And we have this battle. And they're right. We end up in a high fucking court with, you know, the sort of witness statement things, a pile of folders this high. And they've got all my medical records, you know, everything that any psychiatrist has ever said about me. and, you know, specialist psychiatrists saying, you know, the statistics are that an addict who relapses at this point will probably relapse again at that point, and all this kind of stuff. And we battled and we battled and we battled. And after about 5 days, it was clear that it wasn't going to get decided, and we tried to settle. In fact, we came up with quite a complicated arrangement, which was slightly different for each child, but which meant that the two younger children would end up living with me all of the time after a couple of years. And we were just about to settle the deal, but I had this sort of sense that there was a kind of following wind and I was kind of winning. So just before we were about to settle the deal, I said to my solicitor, come on, let's fucking go for it. Let's just push. And she said, Nick, you're mad. You don't know what the judge is thinking. You've got no idea what's going on in his head. Trust me, trust me. And I trusted her. And this slightly kind of strange arrangement, which was slightly different for each of the three children, which I haven't got time to detail, turned out over time to be exactly the right thing for each of the children. Exactly the right thing. Yet another example of my will, you know, not being the right way. So I'm, you know, what was amazing was standing on the stand in the court and having these questions fired at me. It was for 2 days. It was 2 days of cross examination. It was all of my worst nightmares come true, and I got through it, and I got through to the other side, and in a weird kind of way, life's been completely different ever since, if that makes any sense. You know, imagine if the worst things that you think about yourself, somebody presents to you in public at length, in detail, with evidence, and you kind of survive, it's kind of, what is there to worry about after that? But the more important stuff really was, you know, I was able to set about the business of being a father to my children again. I was fortunate, I got married again, I have another child, so I have 4 daughters, and, you know, the relationship with the oldest one was very difficult, and I had to make a decision to let go of that relationship altogether for a while. And, you know, a couple of years ago, she got into recovery. She's 28, she lives in Berlin. Last year, she came and made her amends to me. So, you know, extraordinary things happened. A few years before, obviously, I'd made my amends to her. At the same time that my wife was dying in the hospital in Camberwell, I was working with a sponsee on the second step. We were reading through the second step in the Green and Gold book. And I don't know what was going on. There was something very powerful that evening. I felt this tremendous sense of clarity about what it is that we do with the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And for some reason, I was blessed with that ability to really communicate the passion I felt about this to this sponsee. And all of this was going on at the same time she was dying across London. I didn't know what was going on. It was very strange. But my relationships with my sponsor and my sponsees are one of the things I hold dearest in this. I love this business of being in this chain of experience with this people, you know, people above me who've been around for longer, who know more, and other people who I have some experience to offer to. And often, of course, it's, as we all know, it's the other way around from the way you think it's going to be. And the thing that saves me is the sponsees, not the sponsor. Because I get rung up at a time that not of my choosing with a problem that someone I care about has got. And I have to find a way of responding with empathy, with identification, with any experience I can offer. It saves me again and again. And sponsorship is so powerful, because I get the opportunity. I realised this when this guy who I was sitting doing the second step with while Sarah was dying in Camberwell, he started going through the process of a divorce a couple of years after me. And he was coming to me with all these questions about lawyers and what do I do and how do I handle the resentments against the ex and all this kind of stuff. Suddenly realised that this experience, which up until that point had been completely horrible and useless and painful and grim, had become useful because I had experience to share with somebody else. And that's been true, you know, pretty much for every part of my story now. At some point, it has been experience that I've been able to share with someone else. You know, maybe it's been useful, maybe it hasn't, but I've been able to go through that thing of identifying with another addict in an area where he or she is suffering. Thanks, Charlie. Sometimes think, you know, if we were all... I mean, the power in this room that I talked about at the beginning, it's a gentle, calm power. But think about the power of what it would be like if we were all out there at it. The cumulative damage and criminality and mayhem and pain to those we love. And none of us are doing that tonight. We're all sitting in here. You know, it's a self-evident good for the world, not just for us. It's a great thing. I mean, I feel so blessed to have found recovery again. So blessed. You know, to get it once is fantastic, but to get it twice, you talked about this, is to get it twice. And, you know, it feels now, I mean, I could use again, don't get me wrong, but I feel that I've been given the resources through you, through the meetings, through what I've learned, through working the steps, I've been given the resources where I really do have a choice. I really do have a choice. I really don't have to use, unless I'm going to fucking get perverse and just do it because I feel like it. And I don't feel like it. Coming to the end, I don't really want to talk about smoking and not smoking, except to say that in recovery, kind of 12, 13, 14 years in, I finally put down the cigarettes and I fell apart again. I had a kind of nervous breakdown in recovery. It was terrifying, actually. It was really scary. And I kind of had this kind of, oh, fuck, are the meetings going to hold me? Is it going to be okay? It's the last drug. What am I going to do? Oh, my God. By the way, if you're smoking, it's completely fine. I have no views about it apart from abject envy. Anyway, you know, I fell apart and it took a few months. I took a sabbatical from work. I did 90 meetings in 90 days, actually. And I teased my sponsor who'd given up smoking but had relapsed. And, you know, it was quite encouraging. Relapsed on cigarettes, that is. So the journey seems to kind of go on. And, I feel so blessed. And I think about the timing, you know. I do a lot of meditating these days. The 11th step, I've been so grateful to the 11th step. It's taken me into this stuff of meditation and yoga and all these things. Every now and then I think I'm getting to the point where I have these extended periods of peace of mind that are the thing that I kept chasing after the first time I got it with opiates. I'm getting that from recovery practices. And I mean, I'm the sort of addict who desperately needs peace. I need peace of mind. I can't kind of function with a busy, mad head. But all of this stuff's, you know, been given to me through recovery. It is a journey. Fucking hell. And it's so lovely to have the chance to talk about it at length. We don't normally get it's a 10-minute chair, a 15-minute chair. And, you know, I thank you all for listening with such attention and for your smiles. The smiles are very encouraging. And, you know, if you're in here and you're still using or you're thinking I might go out, please just give it another day. And maybe the person you hear tomorrow at a meeting will be the person, you know, who gives you that message that clicks with you. God bless. Thanks.